one of the descriptions of the heart practices in the commentarial texts of the early Buddhist tradition describes these four kinds of feeling, four kinds of wholesome feeling, using a metaphor of a mother and her children. Those four kinds, again, the first, metta, or loving kindness, friendliness. With metta as a basis, then the next two, how the heart responds to the fluctuating experience of life. When metta or friendliness meets suffering, it transforms into compassion. It's the flavor of kindness turns toward the sense of care or the wish for suffering to be eased. And then the third quality, mudita. So compassion is karuna in Pali and Sanskrit. The third quality, mudita, sympathetic joy or appreciative joy. Sometimes I like just appreciation or celebration for the third Brahma-vihara. The quality that happens when friendliness or kindness meets good fortune, and there's a kind of celebration, a generosity of heart. When a friend of yours is doing well, you just feel good for them. This is mudita. And then the fourth quality, equanimity, upekkha in Pali, the balancing quality and the subtle quality of heart, and it's still a heart practice, but the subtle quality of heart that manifests when we are clear or clear in who we are on our center in relation to both pleasure and pain. A non-reactive but still loving presence. And so the commentary says that these four kinds of love or four kinds of care are like a mother caring for four different children. The first, loving kindness, is this basic care that a mother has for her child, just unconditional care. The second, compassion or karuna, is the kind of care that a mother has for a child who is infirm or suffering or sick. Right? That the ache of just, oh, I would never want to see my child injured or sick. And my child actually is injured right now. He had his worst fall of his life over the weekend, chasing a ball down a slight gravel slope. And he just went face first down. So he's fine, but more blood than I ever have seen yet on his face. He's only 20 months old. I'm sure I'll see more, but it's a start, you know. So it was not too bad for a kind of gentle titration in. But nevertheless, like the feeling of like, oh no, you're suffering. After a couple days of healing, and he didn't feel it, at first he would touch his face, and he'd be like, owie, owie, river, owie. And he'd be like, yeah, you totally got an owie. After a day, he wasn't mentioning it anymore, except when he would catch a glimpse of himself in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And he would see, and he'd go, river, owie. And he'd be like, yeah, totally. He's got all these scars on his... Or, you know, not scars, scabs, big old chunky scabs on his face. He would see it and be like, owie, river, owie. I'm like, yeah, totally. And he'd do the little sign language for owie, owie. Yeah. So the feeling in a parent, I'll gender broaden it because, you know, I'm allowed to feel love for my child as well as mom is. The feeling of a parent for their child who is suffering. And again, it's there's no like distance there, right? It's not pity. It's not like, oh, you know, too bad for you. It's really like, oh no. It's like a part of myself is hurt. Right? And that's like part of the implication in all of these is that like the child is not that separate, really. So it's a love for something that you're so intimate with, a care for the suffering of something you're so intimate with. The third, joy, like the love a parent has for their child who's doing well. Your child is succeeding, thriving, doing new things, using new words, having a great time out in the world. And just this joy at seeing them have a wonderful time. And the fourth, equanimity, the text says, is like the joy that a mother feels, or like the feeling that a mother feels when their child is off in the world doing their own thing. And it's nice to include that one, right? Equanimity. It's like, yep, they're out there. And there's a kind of balance in the mother's being, or in the parent's being. So as we practiced, the quality of compassion is something that we cultivate, and it is this, it is the same as friendliness and care, only it's friendliness and care resonating with suffering that it sees. The guideline to start with somebody who's clearly suffering visibly but is not intimate with you again, is a way to find, in a sense, the purity or the simplest version of this feeling, right? If I think about my beloved and their suffering, my compassion for them is all colored with lots of things, including romantic love and family intimacy and projection and all the things I might be doing in relation to them. You know, oh no, they're suffering because of me. Oh no, their suffering makes me suffer. All the complications that we might come up with if we're intimate with someone. So it says start with someone who's easy. The same way that with the loving kindness practice, we start with someone who's easy to love, not too complicated. Traditionally a teacher or a benefactor. The question comes up, and I was talking with someone recently about compassion and the difference between compassion and empathy. Empathy being this quality of actually feeling in some way the feeling that the suffering person is going through. So I talk with my friend and they're going through heartbreak and my heart feels broken. That's a kind of empathy. And some folks have that quality naturally more strongly than others. Some folks are very empathic to the point of needing to work on boundary, actually, more than receiving. Right? Empathy can be overwhelming, partly because other people's experience is overwhelming. First of all, there's a lot of other people. And so if you start taking on their feelings, that's a lot of feelings. But more subtly than that, there's the sense in the teachings on compassion that empathy is actually not that helpful, particularly because because suffering is disorganizing to the psyche in a certain way. We act less effectively when we're suffering, when we're in distress of some kind. Therefore, if my intention or my desire is to serve or to help relieve suffering, it's exactly not helpful to feel the same feeling as the suffering person. It's more helpful, right, to remain at a skillful distance. If you're a doctor, you know, in a ward full of sick people, it's not that helpful if you catch their sickness. Even though you could then go in and be like, I totally understand where you're coming from. This is terrible, right? You actually want to be like, I'm maintaining my health and you're sick and therefore I can help you. And so compassion sees suffering, cares for it, and the heart, this is again a translation of a commentarial phrase, quivers in response to suffering, but it doesn't feel the same feeling. So the feeling of compassion is distinct from the feeling of distress. That's partly why the compassion itself is a heart feeling. It's part of love. It's not actually distressing. And in a certain way, it's quite pleasurable. Particularly when it breaks through a kind of veil of delusion or denial. When I see the young man who lives near my house on the street, who is, by most standards that I know of, crazy, one could say. At least his behavior is very disorganized in relation to what I would call coherent behavior. It's painful to really pause and sense and see where he's at. But in a certain way, it's more painful to ignore it and to kind of put up a little shield and to just be like, yep, there's the crazy guy, and kind of go about my thing. There's a dissonance in the heart. And I think the heart practice of compassion is delicate because, especially if we are empathic by nature and empathy gets confused with compassion in our experience, opening to his suffering can be destabilizing for me if my sense of compassion isn't clear. If I fall into empathy, say, or I react to his suffering in any of the other ways that I might react, right? I might globalize and be like, he's suffering. Oh my God, you know, that's because Ronald Reagan took funding away from the mental institutions and kicked all the homeless people out on the street, and that's because of neoliberalism. Oh my God, capitalism, we're all going down. That's not an untrue historical narrative, but it's unnecessarily globalizing in relation to his experience and denies him, in a certain way, the specificity of his experience. I think it's actually important when we come into contact with suffering not to generalize it immediately, but to say, this is the exact suffering of this person, this being, based on conditions. Some of the conditions are theirs, right? He might have been addicted to something in his life. Some of the conditions are bigger than him. He might have come from an abusive or deeply unstable family. It's almost certain that he did. Situations like that rarely come out of profoundly coherent homes. But deeply dysfunctional families don't arise on their own, and they come out of dysfunctional communities, they come out of oppression, they come out of culture, which contains everything, right? So in a way, to see a being suffering is also, and this is the wisdom turn, to recognize that their suffering is not their fault as an individual, but they bear their situation in a unique way. And that unique karma, would be the traditional word, is theirs to inhabit and work out. That's the turn toward equanimity. What's happening for him is his karma. Again, not his fault, but his karma. Not his fault, but his ownership of the results of conditions, some of which are his choices and many of which were not. What this means is that compassion can be directed toward any being, no matter their actions or ethics or harmfulness in their own being. In the Visuddhimagga, the big commentary, this is where the suggestion to start with someone who's obviously suffering comes from. The second person they suggest going to, imagining, the commentary offers the possible objection that one could not feel compassion for a bad person. And it brings up the example of a hardened criminal. And it says, you might think that you wouldn't be able to feel compassion for someone who has done all these harmful things. But think of that criminal having been captured by the king, put on trial, thrown in jail, awaiting execution, and being marched to the gallows. And wouldn't you be able to think, oh, that being, no one would want to be in that position, no matter their actions. And so you can be compassionate for their suffering, having landed in this position, even though their own harmful actions got them there. And I think this is really important for us now. It's so easy to cast blame, right? Those other people, in their delusion, voted for that guy, good Lord, right? And it's like, that's kind of easy, and it's kind of true, but it's too easy, and it's not entirely true. And what we want to see through compassion and wisdom, and again, they always come together, is that suffering arises as a result of conditions. And deeply painful suffering arises as a result of vast painful conditions. And I think in a certain way, the more intense the suffering, the bigger we have to look for the conditions. Right? And very much right now, the lens within many of the communities that I'm engaged in is seeing more and more the larger conditions. Even when I began Buddhist practice, there was a strong sense that in a certain way that karma was primarily personal, that it was individual. And this is, in some ways, a traditional viewpoint. One of the wisdoms that the social action folks have brought in is to shine the lens more and more and more and more on systemic conditions, on oppression. And so then it's much, having spent some time with those conversations, it becomes more and more natural for me when I see this young man suffering so deeply to actually just see him not as an isolated example of suffering or an isolated individual, even though his experience might be of deep isolation, but to see that his experience comes from and is embedded in a vast network of unskillful conditions, conditions that lead to pain and harm. That his experience is in part a product of oppression. And one of the ways that I can address it, coming from compassion, and compassion gives rise to the wish or the intention to serve, to help. Part of what I can do is address the systemic conditions. And in a certain way, that's part of the best thing I can do. Sometimes, and I think this often, within a few blocks of my house, there's a whole collection of homeless folks, more and more all the time, depending on which road I go down. On any given day, I'll see a dozen or two dozen folks living on the street. And sometimes I'll think about, if you ever read or saw a version of the Victor Hugo play, Les Miserables, the musical version of which is not good, but I was obsessed with as a teenager, which led me to read the book, which was much better. The seed action that kind of sets off the main character's experience. So the main character is this guy, Jean Valjean, and he has been thrown in prison for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his starving family. So he's a classic hero. And when he finally gets out of, escapes from, I believe, prison, which is intense hard labor, as only the 18th century knew how to do, he reappears in Paris, kind of broken, starving, humbled. And he's taken in by a priest who gives him a lodging for the night and dinner. And Jean Valjean is still caught in the web of his own karma, we would say, use Buddhist language. And he steals a candlestick from the lintel over the fire in the priest's house. He flees, and in the morning is caught by the police, who bring him back to the priest's house. Somehow they know where he's come from. They bring him back, and they show to him, they say, "Is this the man who stole your candlestick?" And Jean Valjean is like, you know, downcast. He's gonna be thrown back into hard labor or executed. And the priest says, "Oh, my friend, I'm so glad you came back. You forgot the second one, the matching one." And he gives him the matching candlestick. And he says, "Thank you, my friends," to the police. "This was my honored guest, and I gave him this gift, and he forgot the second one." The police say, "We're so sorry." They let him go. And the priest gives him a blessing, essentially saying, "Turn your life around." And he does, and he becomes intensely moral. And that's the arc of the whole story from there. That's the beginning of the story. And the rest of the story is him fleeing the police because this police captain has seen through him and makes it his personal quest to destroy him, yada, 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 yada. And there's a young woman he saves, et cetera, et cetera. The love story. It's long book, right? But so there's this act of compassion in the very beginning that sets the whole thing off. So sometimes I'm walking through my neighborhood and I see all of this suffering, all these people living on the street, and it's occurred to me multiple times, like, oh, could I do it? could I be like that priest? Could I just take this person into my house, feed them, take care of them, get them to some to the shelter or to the services or whatever? Could I do that? And there's always some way that I can't. Like, I wouldn't know how to actually trust them. I can't really do that with my baby and my wife without asking. There's all this complication around doing that, I think. I think some of that's true, maybe some of it's not. Even if it were true, what I can't do is take in all 24 people that are living on the street. Maybe I could, right? But I actually can't take in the 100 that I would find if I actually started doing it in my Oakland neighborhood. I actually can't take in the thousands I would find if I let that circle grow even within walking distance of my house. So then what do we do, right? If I can't do that on an individual basis, how do I do it? And one of the ways is to open my lens to the systemic and to say that, you know, each of these individuals deserves to be seen as an individual with their exact story, and I know the system. I know what the mental health system is like and what poverty is like. And somehow, can my actions or my whole life be oriented toward shifting that system somehow? And of course, there's a million ways to try to serve, and that's not entirely the topic of the talk. It's implied. But the quality of compassion itself is the seed of that impulse to serve, and it is valuable in and of itself. And the Brahma-Vihara practice, the practice of the divine abode, suggests that it's an important and healing thing to do to cultivate these heart qualities, even if they don't turn into direct action. And in the action communities right now, there is sometimes a dismissal of personal healing or working on the feelings when they don't lead to direct action. And I think this comes from the very real sense that lots of action needs to be done and more people need to be acting. And that's true. Please act. And when the action isn't connected to these feelings in their clarity, the action can become itself unclear. In addition, the feeling itself does something. This is part of the... there was a question asked last week, you know, is it the case, for instance, that wishing well to other people directly gives rise to their benefit? And there are those studies, right, the prayer studies that say, you know, a group of church ladies in Oklahoma was given the names of a bunch of people in the hospital in, you know, Washington State. They didn't know any of them. It was double blind. Some of the people were in the hospital, some of them weren't. Some of the church ladies were given real names, some were given fake names. It was a well-designed study. And what they found is that the people in the hospital whose names were given to the praying church ladies got better faster, in statistically. What do you do with that? Wishing well to people actually helps them. But that's not actually the purpose of cultivating the Brahma Viharas. The purpose is that they do something for the one who practices them. They do something for you as you do it. If you become more loving, your state and your physiology, your psychophysiology changes. And it's the same with compassion. The development of the feeling of compassion, the quivering of the heart in response to suffering, the way a mother would respond to a sick child or an injured child, that quality is seen as profoundly valuable in and of itself, and hinged not just to the action to relieve other people's suffering, but in a liberation sense, more importantly, hinged to wisdom. The wisdom that it hinges to is the wisdom of non-separation or interdependence, or even more deeply, the emptiness of individuality. When I learn to care deeply for another one of the things I'm doing is I'm decentering the habitual narcissism of caring only for myself and my loved ones. It allows me to get out of the story that my own well-being is so fragile that I only have space to care for it, for myself, and for those that I love. If we take this into a social or identity group or affinity group context, it's natural to feel compassion for those who are like you, who are part of your race or class or ethnicity or gender or sexual preference or ability style or political style. But it's thought of as not so useful, partly because that compassion is colored by different kinds of attachment. Right? I feel compassion for the suffering of Democrats in red states. But it's not real compassion, because I'm actually a little bit kind of grumpy about the situation, and I want them to win. Which partly means get revenge, just to be honest. There's a woman who running for a Congress seat in Kentucky, a Democrat. She was a Marine or an Air Force like fighter pilot. She dropped bombs all over Afghanistan, and whatnot, and you know, and she gives her announcement for running, you know, from the airstrip where fighter planes are behind her, and she's in her uniform, and she's like, you know, they told me I couldn't do it. I went to the Academy of, you know, whatever, and I became a this, and I became a fighter pilot, and I dropped bombs, and I ran all these combat missions, and I did all of this stuff, and, you know, and everyone says that a Democrat can't win in Kentucky. Well, we'll see about that. And her closing image is, you know, her name, you know, for Congress, over a backdrop of her folded uniform and her sword from the Marines. And you're like, okay. You know, I'm like, go for it, right? So, like, I have compassion, right, for a Democrat in such a situation, but it's not this heart quality in the same way as I would generate if I had compassion actually for people I disagree with who are suffering. Because there's a clarity to it. Maybe even I should say, compassion for folks who are not charged in my system in either way. Right, because my compassion for, you know, suffering Trump supporters is different, because it's also charged with a little bit of Schadenfreude, which is the joy at others' suffering. It's the opposite of compassion, and I don't want that. Right, that's not actually healthy. I don't want to support that. Right, so I want to shepherd myself away from, for instance, the media sources that would amplify that. Compassion turns out to be this wisdom quality that sees that no matter who is suffering, suffering is suffering. And that the wish for suffering to decrease can be offered to anyone, no matter the cause of their suffering, no matter their culpability or fault in the suffering, no matter their positions, and no matter their actions. So there's folks out there I dramatically disagree with, right? If that's not clear already. What's it like to, in a sense, compartmentalize in my psyche and say that these are the aspects of their thing that I disagree with, their views or actions, and I can see them through the lens of, this is a suffering being, may your suffering be eased, period, like just that. And that practice both sees their humanity and it uncouples or disentangles them from the views or the culture that they happen to embody. Which means it disentangles them from identity. And particularly the identity that I project onto them. Because they are complicated people. They're not just Republicans. you or your family are Republican, no offense, just flip all the terms. It's the same thing. It's a difficult practice not to demonize the other. And compassion is one of the doorways to doing that. To see the one I think of as demonic actually as hurting. And then to see my own righteousness not as correctness, but also as hurting. Then compassion actually starts to seep into the fixated identities, the fixated self and other. And those fixations can start to fray or soften. And once everyone is a suffering being, everyone is just a being. And then everyone is just everyone. And that's a wise direction. Tolerance and a kind of joy in diversity or difference arise from this wisdom quality. So we cultivate compassion as a clear seeing of suffering and the feeling of care. We recognize that it's different from empathy, feeling the feeling of the other. And when empathy is stronger, discernment toward differentiation is valuable. Oh, this feeling, this is theirs, not mine. This is where we emphasize difference. Because empathy without discernment becomes codependent, it becomes projection and over-identification. I am not actually you, it says. The antidote to empathy says, I'm not actually you. Only when I know that I'm not you can I care for you in a clear way. This is important in relationships, of course. Compassion is the seed of the action of service, and then it is the counterpart to the wisdom that sees non-differentiation. Let's just rest for a moment together. Thanks for listening. And take some time to bring in your voices, your sense of this quality, aspects of how you find it unfolding in your practice, in your life. Questions and inquiry. Natalia.
Thank you, Sean. In my experience, suffering actually had a very positive effect on my development. Yeah. Like I found out that only through like suffering and pain, I understand that it's time to change,
yeah,
and actually do something about it. So it kind of moves me to become, to do something different.
Yes.
Right? So I think it's kind of a good thing, mm-hmm, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But like, where is that line where it becomes a bad thing? Like sometimes you're like,
mm-hmm,
it's uncontrollable. And especially in relationship to people who I'm attached with, like with my family,
mm-hmm,
like, they're a great cause of suffering to me.
Yes.
I cannot escape it.
Yes.
It's, mm-hmm, like, it's endless. It's like, yeah, I wish it stops. It doesn't. And like, I want to end it, and I don't really, like, I keep changing things, and I'm still suffering.
Yes. Yes.
Like in your last lecture last week, you mentioned that you developed that love and feeling towards your mother over the time. Like I wish I have that feeling inside towards like my family where I'm like kind of experiencing mm-hmm. mom and feelings when yeah. they drive me crazy, but yeah, I wasn't gonna keep them coming from that.
Yeah. I mean, two pieces. You started with the piece of how suffering really can be a good thing when it's the seed of change, of doing something different. And it's beautiful, very much so. And that's, we hope for that. And it takes a certain kind of clarity to be able to wake up in the middle of suffering and say, oh, I want to do this differently. Enunciated in one of the Buddhist lists that starts with the quality of suffering and ends with full liberation. And it goes from suffering into faith, into concentration and joy, essentially. Like, through suffering, I turn toward what could help, and I find the path, and I begin to practice, and my faith arises. So that's a very traditional pathway. And it has to be that way, right? We all start with suffering, and then we have to get on to something better. So it's the basis of everyone's situation. This is the basis of the Buddha's situation. He started suffering and then went looking for something else. The second part is harder. Family, you mentioned. And the endless suffering of family, to which, in a certain way, I can only bow to you and be like, yes, I too have a family. And family can be very, very difficult. And there's no getting away from them, right? And the teachings on compassion perhaps can help a little bit. And what they would do is they would suggest that instead of thinking that I should be able to love my family in a clear way, to just recognize that it's difficult, that they're difficult, that there's a lot of suffering in the family field, and that one of the things I can do is I can see my family members also as suffering beings. They're suffering because of the situation as well. They're suffering because their parents suffered. They're suffering because of the situation of views or their culture, a million different ways that you can see them also as suffering. And that becomes the possibility, perhaps, of a change of view, where rather than them being these things like, I'm supposed to love them, it's really hard, they do these things that make me crazy, I'm constantly suffering, you shift the attention from your suffering onto theirs. And you say, oh, these people are suffering. No wonder they do all this stupid stuff that makes me crazy, right? If, you know, I wish that their suffering would be eased. And that can turn around the kind of onslaught of, you know, I'm suffering because of what they... I might still be suffering. But my relationship to what they're doing could shift some. So you could play with that.
Yeah, it's kind of... I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to do from a distance.
Yes, indeed. It is easy to do from a distance.
Yeah, like I love them. Like, I feel a lot of love inside of me towards them.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can't, for example, stand them for more than an hour or two.
Yeah. Do you have to live with them?
No, I
think. Oh, good.
Anymore.
Well, there you go. So that's a start. Appropriate distance is a whole thing with family. And there's no requirement that you have to spend a lot of time with them. You're connected, and you will spend some time with them given whatever your family situation is, probably. But yeah, it can be part of your practice to know what your boundary is in relation to that, and to care for yourself in that experience, to not lose yourself in it. So, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Other thoughts?
I find myself thinking about a type of compassion that you're not explicitly talking about. Mm-hmm. It might be folded in there. to the four kinds, but it's one that comes up in my work a lot, which is the compassion that causes suffering in someone else because of the end game. So maybe in the mother terms, it would be the mother having to discipline their child, the child that wants to eat sugar all day long or that's acting out. And so you have to not give them what they want.
Right.
You have to say no. You have to set limits. You have to give boundaries. So in a sense, you're causing quite a bit of distress in another person because that's the most compassionate thing that you know to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mom's got to do it.
And it seems to, though, be one that gets lost or that's hardest for people to understand as compassion.
Maybe those people aren't parents.
Yeah.
It seems quite clear to me. Yeah, the feeling the mother is having is based in, well, that's interesting. Compassion is a feeling where kindness encounters suffering that is happening, and then it feels an ache. If I see my child who is wanting sugar, am I seeing suffering? Not completely. I'm seeing a want, which has the child wants sugar. It's a little bit they want it. It's a little suffering. But it's not like I'm seeing them wounded. It's more like I am seeing into the future and I'm tracking the arc of their development. And I'm just saying, this is my choice. It's my responsibility to make choices that you can't make. Therefore, I'm making this choice. So there's some compassion in it. There's also a kind of like discernment, really, is a kind of quality where I have to track what's, what's wholesome and non-wholesome. So there's an element of wise effort would be in there. And the reason I'm trying to sort of parse the qualities is because I'm curious, and maybe others have an idea about this, I'm curious if it's exactly compassion per se. I think once I say no and the child is throwing a fit on the floor, then I feel compassion, right? Then I'm like, I see that you're suffering. I do ache that you're suffering, and I know that tantrums are appropriate for emotional development, and I'm still not going to give you sugar, so I'm compassionate, and I'm holding the line. So I'm going to comfort you. I'm going to get down on the floor and be like, you really wanted it, didn't you? And like, you really wanted it. Yeah, but you can't. But you can't have any. And like, I know that hurts. You really want it, but you can't. Like, I'm compassionate but holding it. So there's compassion there. And then I'm just curious about the compassion in discipline. Not in punitive discipline, which I would not call compassion. But in kind of preventative discipline. And I value it. I think it is, it is a kind of, it's almost like preventing suffering rather than responding directly to it. So I think it's important. I would call it, maybe for myself, I would call it more discernment than compassion in a certain way. I'm not sure it matters what we call it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What about self-compassion on the part of the parent? Like having compassion for yourself if that child eats all the sugar and how your life will be suffering.
Well, again, it's not compassion if I'm projecting to the future. That's anticipation. I'm anticipating suffering.
Okay.
So it's not, my heart is not quivering with suffering. My heart is actually a little bit firm in like, no, we're not going there. But there's all these moments where like the child is doing whatever they're doing and I'm under-resourced and I'm having a hard time. And then, again, the quality of compassion would arise. And I think I'm trying to be detailed with this because part of what we're going for is the feeling of this state. And the feeling is always present moment. And so when it's coming up in relation to past or future, it's a little bit different, I think, because it's a teeny bit not present in this moment.
What if your child was an addict and you have to not comfort them in a moment to let them hit bottom?
For sure.
That is like there's direct suffering in this moment.
Absolutely. So that's different than my child wanting sugar.
Yeah, that's just the simplest, just to match your metaphor.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in that case, it's it's not that I'm anticipating the suffering that they'll have when they get a fix. It's that I'm seeing their direct suffering right now. And of course, that's a wrenching feeling, you know, of which there would be compassion, of course. And then the action that you might have to take could be a very difficult one to take, right? To like do something that hopefully would be skillful to get them to change. And the hope would be that the compassion is clear enough and disentangled from the intimate relationship enough to be able to act clearly. And my very tiny example of this is in sleep training, where like part of our sleep training was, you know, he has to night wean, therefore I go in to comfort him, but no matter how much he screams and cries for mama and milk, he can't have it. So then my sweetheart is totally suffering, lying awake in the other room going, I can't stand to hear him cry, and she really wants to come in, and we have to hold the line. And I have to be like, no, I'm going to comfort him, I'm going to hold him, I'm going to sing songs, he's going to get lots of care, but not milk. We do that, and that's what's useful in that moment. So I have to, we both feel, I feel compassion for both of them, and a little bit for myself, but it's not too hard. I can deal with crying. It's my job. But I have to do that thing, sort of care and hold the line in that moment. I can't imagine having to do it with a child who is an addict, you know, or in a worse situation. I hope I never have to.
I was just thinking about something that literally like just came up, where I've been planning to go on a solo camping trip, not in a super isolated area. Like, I researched it and thinking about it for a long time, wanting to do it, and I kind of struggled with whether or not to tell my parents that I was going to do it, because I was anticipating their fear.
Yeah.
But I wanted to. I didn't want to lie to them, so I told them, and it seemed like they were okay, but then I got a text from my mom saying, like, you know, please don't do this, it's really stupid, you know, like, basically, like, giving a very obvious, like, clear, strong opinion of, you know,
yeah,
doing it. And I can really see how in the past, I was aware of my reaction to seeing it. My reaction was anger, and also, but the anger was kind of because I doubted my decision to do it when I had spent a lot of time like deliberating that was something and feeling into it and
yeah.
really do feel deep down that I want to do it. So I was thinking, like, is that? But at the same time, I have compassion for her because I know she's just afraid. You know, she loves me. She's afraid. She cares for me.
Yeah.
So it's like this weird, like, simultaneous, like, empathy that I feel there's, like, some unclarity where my own opinion is, like, being tugged at by being aware of her pain. But then there's also, like, compassion. And I was just wondering, do you think it's more compassionate to... Like, if someone has a reaction like that, and it's, like, very strong, and you know, they're not necessarily willing to change their own opinion of the situation, is it better to just not tell them? Or,
well, I don't know.
This is entirely conditional.
It's entirely conditional, right. You know, you're describing an intimate relationship, family, where everything is layered, right? There's layers of care and fear and control and any number of things, right, on both sides. So all of that mixing together. And then our question always is like, well, what do I do in relation to that? What's an appropriate action?
Yeah.
And from a practice perspective, before I can know what's an appropriate action, I have to know what the feeling is that's impelling the action. Because only when I sense what the base feeling is, am I going to sense whether the intention arising out of that is wholesome or unwholesome. Mm. So whether to tell or not tell is a skillful or unskillful maneuver is going to depend on my assessment of all the conditions, particularly of the intention it's arising from. So that means that before I figure out what to do, I have to disentangle the web of feelings that are happening. Like you're doing, where you're describing there's compassion for her fear, but there's also anger because her, you know, statement gave rise to my own feeling of doubt, even though I was certain before. And so you're tracking your own shift from certainty to doubt, from, you know, the desire not to tell to the decision to tell out of a kind of ethical groundedness, and then dealing with the results of telling, which you might have anticipated. I'm sure you anticipated. You knew what she was going to say. So all of that is present, and you can kind of lay it all out in a certain way, spend time with it essentially in feeling, right? And then you'll get a sense of which of those feelings is strongest and is therefore the one creating the impulse toward the next action. Because right? The action is going to be coming out of kind of one of those things, essentially, is going to leap forward and say, well, let's just do this, you know. And then you want to be like, oh, who's saying that? Is it the doubt saying that? Or the anger saying that? Or my old certainty saying that? And once you get a sense of that, then you can be like, okay, it's coming from this feeling, therefore I can sense whether it's grounded in my wish for non-harming, or if it's grounded in something else, like wanting to be right, or wanting to get to do what I want, or whatever that is. So it's all conditions, right? I wouldn't say that there's an absolute to tell or not to tell. When I told my parents I was going to hitchhike solo across the country,
your dad was...
And my dad said, how about never? And I did it anyway. You know, that was me. But I also wasn't... I didn't go through this process with them. You know, I was kind of... I was a bit maybe more of a... I was maybe a little more immature than you are now. So certainly I was less considerate than you are. Anything else here? And then we'll close for the night. Yeah, Lisa.
I was thinking about the withholding sugar, right, that you were talking about, and kind of piecing apart what you were saying, and I'm thinking of...
Thank you, take care. Yes.
Compassion and wisdom, and I think as a mother, the feeling would come with wanting her to have sugar. That would be sort of the feeling, and then the discernment, the wisdom would be to then get a little distance and say, this is not going to be good. And so you were talking about, you know, trying to get into the flavor of the feeling of compassion.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, it might be empathy, it might be, I don't know, but the to draw the line is something that's a little bit different. And then I was thinking of what Caitlin was saying about withholding the information about your solo camping trip. And my daughter is 30 today, and there have been times when she's told me what she's done, and she said, you know, I realized that this would make you really anxious, and so I didn't tell you. And I felt that was very compassionate of her, that was where she seemed to be coming from, and I really, really appreciated it, because she was right, and she's a completely independent adult, and... So I didn't have any say over whether she did it or not. And I appreciated her owning it and doing it and saving me the heartache.
Equanimity, the quality of a mother when their child is off doing their own thing.
Yes.
Right? So saith the commentary.
She said, Mom, I knew that would freak you out. And oh, thank you, Lord.
Thanks for not telling me. Yeah. Yeah. Good. So we'll end. We should end there for the night. We'll continue next week, so please come back. Next week we'll do joy, appreciative joy, same talk really, but flipped toward how awesome things can be. As always, we are operating within the beautiful practice of the gift economy. Your gift of your resources of money and anything else you bring, strawberries, lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens, is gratefully appreciated. Money is split in half between the studio and myself and supports us to keep the group an offering for everyone to come. So thank you for your generosity. And gifts go in the basket there on the shelf. And we'll see you all next week. Take good care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Take a handful of strawberries. And-